Welcome to the Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church.
Well, welcome to Keys of the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory, and we're going to talk again about the Kingdom of God. And this morning we were talking about symbiosis. I know a number of people that went to the symbiosis event here in Oregon, which is supposedly not quite like Burning Man. Instead of being overwhelmed by alkali dust, which you always see at Burning Man, because it's on an alkali flat, at Symbiosis, they were overwhelmed by clay dust. So the differences are rather insignificant. Supposedly, it's more of a family-oriented event and that sort of thing. But there was a lot of wild stuff there. And the people I know who went to the event, I mean, the people that I know personally who went to the event, I know of a lot of people who went to the event, went there as vendors to provide housing, etc., as a matter of, you know, they do this at fairs and what have you. But they had a first-hand seat to see a lot of the stuff going on. And, of course, since we want to have festivals here, it's a great learning experience, except for the fact that most of these music festivals that you see, not all maybe, not all the festivals, there's lots of festivals. It's quite a phenomenon how many festivals are out there. I should do a show. And I've done some research on what I would call the festival phenomena. Of course, Israel had festivals, but their purpose was quite a bit different than the reason that people go to things like Symbiosis and Burning Man. The Burning Man Symbiosis festivals are often presented as music festivals, and people go there to hear supposedly music. And Symbiosis, of course, the word means living together, and so they have this kind of theme that it's all about living together and as a community. Well, living together, and this is what we kind of covered in the shows this morning, living together has a lot of different definitions and ceremonies and rituals or things that you would do to live together. And, of course, the word symbiosis there's supposedly three different types of symbiosis. I'm a shepherd. I raise sheep, and shepherds and sheep have a symbiotic relationship. And that relationship will fall under one of these three categories, generally speaking. There's actually about five categories, according to some approaches to symbiosis, but there's at least three major ones. Which the first one is mutualism, where both partners in this symbiotic relationship benefit. And commensalism is, or commensalism, it depends on how you want to say it, I suppose, but it's C-O-M-M-E-N. It's kind of, you know, it's not really the common word like that, but it has, you know, with benefits, but the benefits in commensalism is on one side. The other side doesn't really benefit from it, from the relationship. They aren't harmed by the relationship, but they are not benefited by the relationship. But that's a form of symbiosis because one of them receives a benefit. The third one, the common one, is parasitism. And that one is where one benefits, but the other one suffers or loses. It's a host in the relationship. And that is, unfortunately, that's a lot of what goes on at Symbiosis and Burning Man is more of a parasitism. There are a couple other forms of symbiosis that are worth mentioning. They are separate categories and not considered part of the three main categories because they're kind of overlapping a little bit. And one is competition. Competition itself, they don't really benefit simply or directly from their relationship, but indirectly they do. And it has to do with competition where Because they compete, I mean, why do giraffes have long necks? Is because of competition. They have to reach above the competition to get the leaves of the trees where that helps them survive. Deers run fast. Animals develop humps where they store food, and that helps them through famine, etc. All these things are the result of competition, or are part of the competition in an environment. The other so th but they have an effect and a benefit, side benefits for some animals, because the more things you have living in an area, the more things you can have living in an area. To a certain degree, you can overgraze and things like that too, but life begets life. Life produces life, but all life is not mutualism. All entities living together are not living together under the principles of mutualism. The other ones, like parasitism, and the last one, which I thought I should mention as well, is predation. The wolf hunts the deer, the coyote hunts the deer, and this has an effect on the environment, on the deer, and also, of course, fills the belly of the wolf. Predation is a part of a symbiotic relationship. Now, where would the shepherd fall into these categories? Would he be a predator? I mean, he's eating his sheep, he's devouring his sheep, but it's not predation, it's mutualism, because the sheep are fed in the winter, they're protected from the predators, they are provided care for, they're overseen, they're led along still waters and made to lie down in green pastures, which are provided by the shepherd. So it's a mutualism. They're both benefiting from each other. If the shepherd dies, the flock dies, because it cannot survive on its own, generally speaking, in most areas. You can find some islands where the flock will survive even on the island, but I gave an example on shows a number of weeks ago about an island in the Caribbean that, or Mediterranean actually, it's off the coast of Greece, that have goats on it. And the goats reproduce until there are so many goats that they eat up all the grasses, and then there's a huge starvation and die-off, and some goats survive and live. And then they start over again because the grasses start catching back up. Well, that's because there's no shepherd. There's nobody but, famine that is regulating the size of the herd and the maintenance of the herd. There's no shepherd. And so shepherds form a mutualism. Nature will find a way to solve this problem, but it's not always humane people. People are bringing in wolves into areas like Yellowstone and other areas like Oregon here, and they have this crazy idea that you need the wolves in order to create this natural environment. And it's so natural because it keeps the deer from overgrazing, the elk from overgrazing near the waterways, which overgrazing causes erosion, and the erosion changes the course of the stream and pollutes the stream and affects the fish. Well, hiring wolves to go out there and chase the deer away and to hunt the deer and to keep their population down is not management. I mean, my fields would grow, my sheep would grow to a gigantic herd if they were left completely alone. If I bring in wolves, they will not grow to a gigantic herd because the wolves will kill off those. But that's poor management, because a wolf is just. Wolves will go out there and they will hunt, cougars as well, will hunt and kill when it's not necessary. They don't just kill when they're hungry, they kill for sport. And they don't just, shoot a deer and then take all the meat and preserve it, etc., etc. They go out and they gut young deer or elk, or they'll kill the young and tear them apart while they're still living. They're very, it's a predator. They're very violent. I've seen what appears to be a wolf I mean, we thought it was a wolf attack one of our sheep and tear off the entire front leg all the way up to the shoulder, just tore it off. Sheep was still alive, but bleeding out when we got there. And it ran off with the entire leg. That's not humane. That's predator stuff. And, you know, that's okay. Somebody eventually shot the wolf, and that was fine with us. Because we don't have a place for wolves just to be running free and protected out here anymore. Because, I mean, if you know, I've seen wolves out here a long time ago, but they stay very much away from people, and they avoid people and livestock. But when the government is protecting the wolf and not protecting the farmer, the wolf gets to run rampant over there. And also, they brought in the wrong kind of wolves. And, you know, if you hunt the wolf, if you get to shoot at him, if you get to hunt him with dogs, they stay away. I mean, that's what cougars, you hunt a cougar, and the cougar doesn't go anywhere near a place that has the smell of a dog, because they know the dog. They're not afraid of the dog. They're afraid of the hunter, who will shoot them out of the tree when the dog has them up in the tree. They will go up in a tree and just sit there and wait till the dog goes away. Or they'll go down and tear the dog apart. But if there's a hunter around with a gun, they won't do that. As a matter of fact, they will avoid a dog catching their scent. But now, since you can't hunt cougars anymore with dogs in Oregon, because the government made it illegal, cougars will run up and grab a dog right off a front porch or a back porch in Lakeview and hop over the fence with the dog in his mouth. You know, I mean, bobcat will do this with young pups if they're protected. But if you shoot them, they won't do that anymore. it won't end the existence of bobcats and mountain lions, but it will make them wary of the smell of humans, because humans are a predator too. They give them a wide berth, just like the grizzly in Alaska. They don't mess with them, because a grizzly is a powerful predator. But if you wanted to control the elk in Yellowstone, you should open it up occasionally to hunting. And they will stay away from, you know, you'll still see them, but they'll keep their distance. They won't be grazing out amongst the tents and the people. They'll be a little more wary. And that's called management. And that's what we were put here on earth to do, is dress it and keep it. So anyway, at the symbiosis that we pointed out, this parasitism. And parasites are ingenious, like we said. I mean, there are wasps that actually go and will sting a bug that is way bigger than it. But it will sting it in its brain, so that it continues to live and breathe and function, but it no longer resists the wasp, and the wasp can just lead it away and then lay its eggs. And when the eggs hatch out, they will devour the fresh, live roach that that has been stung, and its brain has been incapacitated, so it no longer resists the wasp, and it allows itself to be eaten. Well, that's what's happening in the world today. We have been drugged. We have been stung in our minds so that we allow ourselves to be eaten, our children to be eaten, cursed our children with debt. They're devoured. They're forced to work as slaves. You know, people don't realize, you know, people, all this talk recently, Antifa and Black Lives Matter. Oh, slavery's so bad. Get rid of Robert E. Lee. One of Robert E. Lee's generals was famous for incorporating strategies in the community that gave black voices in not only in government, but in all agencies of the economy. And he was famous for helping blacks become viable members of society after the end of slavery. Robert E. Lee himself freed his own slaves. Freed them. Didn't sell them. He freed them. Grant didn't do that. And so we don't understand with our modern education, a socialist education, exactly what was going on. These men were often of great character. They had flaws. And you have to remember, I mean, the first slave owner in America was a black man who owned another black man. And that's where slavery was first legalized in America. Almost every black slave that was brought to America had first been enslaved by black men, not by white men. And a very small number of white men even owned slaves. And they were not the only thing that was moving the Southern economy. It was a part of some of the economy. Most people who did own slaves, the slaves ate in the same house, often at the same table as their owners. They were taken care of. They were not necessarily abused and beaten all the time. But yet, slavery, it's an institution, been around for a long time. Lots of white people have been slaves throughout history. But it breeds abuse. But the reality is today, you know, like in Egypt, there were very few slaves. Slavery was never very important in Egypt. And we explain this in the book Covenants of the Gods. We show you. And even when we talk, we see these movies, you know, Charlton Heston and Moses and all these slaves, all these people are slaves. They were in a corvée system of statutory bondage. Only 20% of their labor was taken away from them every year. They weren't in abject slavery. They were paid most of the year, but 20% of the time they were not paid. They had to labor for free for the Pharaoh, or whatever labor they did went to the Pharaoh. Well, that's going on today in America and Australia and Canada. It's called corvée, where a portion of your labor goes to the government and you work for free. If you work at McDonald's, part of those big burgers you flip, you're flipping for free, because what you earn is not going to you. They will put it in an envelope and they will send it to the government. And it's a corvée system of statutory bondage. If anybody can take a portion of your check that you get for the work you do and send it off to somebody else, you're in bondage. You're a slave. And people don't like to hear that, but unless you are willing to see the truth, you cannot fix it. You got to, you know, I had a guy working on my car once who was evidently deaf, or deaf enough. And he said, well, yeah, it's all working. It was an old truck. And I said, what's that banging noise? He says, what banging noise? That clanking. You could hear this clank, 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 clank. And he couldn't hear it. He was deaf. So he wasn't going to fix it because, you know, it's kind of like the guy who says, maintenance light keeps going on. And he says, oh, you just put a piece of electrical tape over that. And it'll fix it, right? It's not really fixing anything. So anyway, society has to see what's really going on. And the fact is there are some people who are good at organizing and putting together a business and running a business, and they can see all aspects of it, and they are very successful at it. And some people are fairly good managers but can't own a business. They need to have somebody else make the decision for them, and then they will implement it. They're good managers of people, but they do not see the whole aspect of business. And men like to work for them. They treat their men well, and they're just good at it. And their place is in management. There should be. Unfortunately, a lot of people that are good at doing work or promoted to management, and they're not good at doing the management, which is part of what they call the Peter principle, where people are promoted and promoted until they're finally promoted to a position where they're not suited for that position, and then they remain there because they never do it well enough to be promoted to the next position. But there are other people who are not good managers, but are good employees. They can follow instructions. They don't mind monotonous work. They like doing the same thing. They find a certain security in doing the same thing over and over again, and they are very good at it. And they're good employees, but they would not be good managers, and they would not be good business owners. Now, that may change over the life of the time. As a matter of fact, I don't believe that anybody is a good manager until he's been a good employee. It's kind of a progressive thing. You have to learn how to follow orders before you are very good at giving orders. But you may be this follower of orders from your childhood. You did what your folks told you. You did what your parents told you. You did what your teachers told you. Hopefully your teachers are your parents. But anyway, that's another story. But you learn to do what you were told, and then you just fell right into management when you got older. And if you were good in management, maybe you're also good in business, and you can run your own business. And, you can have your own business without employees. You can have your own business with employees. It just depends on what kind of business and your capability of managing them. But all these relationships, employee, employer, are symbiotic. But what form? Parasitical? Mutualism? Well, a good employer-employee relationship is mutualism. You're benefited by the employee because he's doing work you need done that you can't do yourself because you're too busy. But he's benefited because you pay him. Now, how much is mutualism and how much is taking advantage? Well, if you talk to a socialist, all capitalists are taking advantage and using and abusing people, but they're usually full of hate and anger and prejudice. And one of the things we talked about is class system, classism, if you might even call it. Racism is a form of classism, where you're a member of a particular class because you're white. You're a member of a particular caste because you're black. And in India, they actually talk about the untouchables as being the blacks, although they may all be the same color as far as skin, but they still talk about them as blacks. And that's a form of, elitism, classism, whatever you want to call it. We have that in England. We have it in America. And you can make the categories not just race, you can make it rich. Oh, he's a rich person, so now he's in another class. He's a poor person, he's in another class. But the kingdom of heaven is constantly promoting the idea of brotherhood. And one of the ways they do it is through their festivals. And one of the festivals in particular, which is a unique festival, which is called the Passover, you had to invite enough people into your house or be invited into somebody's house so that you could finish off an entire lamb before morning. You had to eat the entire thing before morning. They roast it whole, and you had to eat the whole thing before morning. Well, that's a lot of meat. I mean, even Lewis and Clark's people were only eating like 9 pounds of meat a day, and that was a hard working day. So that means if you got 100-pound sheep, or 150-pound sheep, you might have 75 pounds of meat. Well, that's a lot of meat to eat. So you're going to have a lot of people there. Well, what house are they going to? Are they going to go to the little house in town, the poor man's house, or they're going to go to the rich man's house? Well, they're going to go to somebody who has a house big enough for everybody to be. And so you're going to bring rich and poor together. Because the other rich men, they don't want to leave their house to go to your house. They would rather invite other people into their house. And so that was part of the deal. And then, of course, the festivals themselves, rich young men meet poor young girls, or poor rich young girls meet big, strong, strapping, poor men, hardworking men, and they get married because they come to the festival and meet one another. And meet each other, and sparks fly. So all these festivals were to bring people together, but because the kingdom of God is symbiotic relationship, but it's based on mutualism, voluntary mutualism. Socialism could be called mutualism, but it's not voluntary. Socialism is like when Nimrod gets to decide how much you're going to give and who's going to get the benefit of what you produced. But in the kingdom of God, which is capitalism, you are in charge of what you produce, and you have to decide how to share it to make it mutualism so that you can live together in this symbiotic relationship where everybody benefits. Now, from, and I said this morning, from each according to their ability, to each according to their need. I believe in that philosophy. But I don't believe in communism, and I don't believe in socialism, which also claim to believe in that philosophy. I believe that each individual should have what they produce. It's theirs. And I believe that each individual should decide how much of what they produce they want to share. Somebody else doesn't make that decision for them. They make that decision. Now, I believe that each individual that has a need, we should help them in their need. But what is their need? I have no money. I have no food. I need food. I need money. Maybe I don't need food. Maybe I don't need money. What I really need is to get up out of bed before 7 o'clock in the morning and get to work and produce something of value. And then I can go out and buy food. And I will have money because I produced something of value and I traded with somebody else who also got up early in the morning and produced something else I didn't have time to produce. And so we traded. He grew apples and I grew watermelon, and he likes watermelon, so I gave him some of my watermelon and he gave me some of his apples. But we both produced something. And that's mutualism. The market is mutualism. We're sharing our surplus with those who produce things that we have not been able to produce. That's capitalism, that's social, that's mutualism. It's not socialism, because socialism is where what you produce is not really yours. It belongs to the community, and the community can decide to take it away. Well, both are symbiotic relationships, but one is a little bit more predacious. And even if the person who's going to reap the benefits of what you have produced, that's very much like parasitism. That's a parasitical relationship. Where the poor, you know, today the poor have enslaved the hardworking middle class. The rich get out of taxes a lot of times, not always, because they can hire lawyers and bookkeepers and accountants. But the middle class are hit the hardest. And they're required to support the people on welfare. So the people on welfare are parasites feeding on the sweat, blood, and toil of the middle class. And occasionally a little bit of the rich. But, I mean, the rich will pay taxes, but they always end up still being rich. It's like the time when England, you know, went after the rich to increase the tax load on the rich by in implementing all these, preventing all these tax deductions and everything, and went after the rich so they would pay a bigger share. And the following year after these were implemented, it ended up, the statistics showed that the rich paid less. Because as soon as they put all these plans into place, the rich just went out and reorganized their finances with clever bookkeepers and lawyers and got around the tax and ended up paying less. Now, they may not have done that had there not been this covetous attack upon what they were producing. And you have to admit that a lot of the rich are the biggest donators to the poor. And we talked about that this morning, how people donate in Bend, Oregon. And so this allows homeless people to get new tents every month, you know, new sleeping bags, etc. And then they go around squatting, and they will squat in an area, some, not all, but some will squat in an area so much, and some of their practices are so unhygienic, the state literally has to bring in a hazmat company to remove their abandoned garbage and tents. Well, those poor people need something, but they don't need new tents and they don't need new sleeping bags. They need to learn how to take care of themselves. They learn how to, you know, operate in a more hygienic way so they do not contaminate the area that they dwell in for more than a month or a couple of weeks. Maybe somebody just needs to learn how to get up in the morning and apply themselves. Because I've talked to some of these homeless, and they choose to not work. They choose to be homeless. They're getting a check, and they use it on drugs and what have you. They do not apply themselves with enthusiasm or ingenuity to their life. They squander their life. And Jesus talks about the guy who is given a talent, and he squanders his, he doesn't do anything with it. He doesn't waste it. He's not the prodigal son, but he just buries it and does nothing with it. And Jesus is totally against that. And so what that person needs who's burying their talent, wasting their talent on self-indulgence, they need to be scolded. They need to be rebuked and turn around and go the other way. That's what they need. They don't need another handout. You're weakening the poor. You're enabling the poor. And so you need to have ministers out there who can help those who are willing to be helped in a righteous way, because that's what we're seeking, the kingdom of God and his righteousness. And you need to have them going out, showing people how it's done. Show them the symbiotic relationship that is based on mutualism and not predation or parasitism. And that's very important, that we learn these things and that we teach other these things and show them these are the ways of the kingdom. And that's what we need to learn, and that's what we need to do. Welcome back. So hearing about the keys of the kingdom, what does that mean? It means the keys to liberty under God. The kingdom of God is about being in a government under the authority of God, not under the authority of other men. You do, because we're forbidden to exercise authority one over the other. Now, obviously, if you break into my house and try to steal the food off my table or hurt my children, I get to exercise authority over you because you just waived your rights when you come smashing into my front door. And when you try to take away my life or the lives of my children, which we have a symbiotic relationship, I benefit them. They benefit me. They are part of my creation. So if you battle against that, then I get to battle against you. I mean, because you have waived your right. I mean, if you pull a gun out and try to kill somebody, you have now created an environment in which they get to kill you. And because you have decided to usurp their rights, now your right to live is forfeited. And so that's just the way reality works. That's nature. That's how a society is organized under nature. What does this all mean, and where can we take this symbiosis, and what we're talking about here as far as living together? What does it mean to really live together, to be a part of a community of mutualism, voluntary mutualism? See, socialism and communism is not a voluntary mutualism. It's forced mutualism. And because somebody is going to have the power to exercise force, we know, or that power will corrupt somebody, because power corrupts, and that's a power. So people who want communism and socialism, what they really should want, I don't know what they really want, but what they think they want is mutualism, voluntary mutualism, where you will actually lay down part of your life in order that somebody else might live. And if you do that, then you will have a life more abundant. That's what voluntary mutualism, form of symbiosis, that you should want. Unfortunately, that's not what the people are getting at these festivals. That's what you will get at the Burning Bush Festival. Everybody who comes to the Burning Bush Festival should bring, they ask, what should we bring? Well, what do you want to share? What would you like to share with other people? We have people who give us, you know, bring food to us, you know, from Costco, big pies and things like that. And although they're tasty, we gave the last one away. Because you can't, you know, we don't have all our kids home. And so we can't eat all that stuff. And then plus the pies at Costco are made with 10 times more sugar than we would put in a pie. And we don't think that's really healthy for you. But we happen to have a lot of apples right now, so we're making our own pie. But we will share what we have with others. And that's why we have the festival here every... And right now, their festivals are pretty small. But we could make them bigger. But we know the only purpose of having the festivals is to bring the congregations together. And everybody's hesitant about making a congregation. We're the only ones out there who are really preaching this effectively. To that Christianity is about coming together to serve one another. It's not about coming together to feel good or to sing songs or to be served by others. It's about you coming together so you can lay down part of your life to serve others. And it takes a certain kind of minister and it takes a certain kind of congregant. But if we were to gather large congregations together, I mean, they're small congregations, large numbers of congregations together in this tens, hundreds, and thousands, we will have a place to expand larger festivals. And people bring their own talent. They play music. They can dance. They can sing. They can probably not smoke dope and get drunk and roll around naked in the mud bath down at the lake, which is what was going on at Symbiosis. We don't want to have women walking around flaunting their natural bodies, perverting the natural use of their bodies to some sort of voyeurism, trying to get power over men, which we see a lot going on at Symbiosis and other places. We want people to come and with a morphic resonance of Christ, with the character of Christ. Now, I mention morphic resonance because it's a term that's used by Rupert Sheldrake, and I talked about him a little bit briefly. There are these 10 principles of science that everybody talks about if you're a scientist. Everything is essentially mechanical is the first one. A dog is simply a complex mechanism rather than a living organism that might even make choices. And so therefore the human being is just a complex dog. So a human is just a mammal. So we don't really make choices. We are all the product of our genetics and our environment. As Richard Dawkins says, we're just big lumbering robots, you know, carbon-based robots. Not so. That there's actually a soul inside people and they do make choices. And but they are heavily influenced by the world, the flesh, and the devil, their DNA, the circumstances around them, etc. How do you get uninfluenced? We talked about the parasites that, you know, are drugged by a wasp and then led off to become the meal of their offspring. And they willingly go because they've been drugged. Well, do you know anybody who's been drugged lately? Are drugs prevalent in the country? Is religion the opiate of the people today that drugs millions upon millions of people to sit in Christian churches and think they are saved while they are cursing their children with more and more debt every day, while they participate in covetous practices and literally pray? You can call it applying, but that's what prayer is application. They pray to the fathers of the earth and the benefactors of the world who exercise authority one over the other to obtain benefits, social benefits, through the sacrifice of their neighbor, but an involuntary sacrifice, not based on charity, but based on force. I told the story of some of our in-laws from Sweden who was teaching in schools, and the schools were all private schools. They were the Waldorf schools. And the parents were very much involved. They've been doing this their whole life. And now they get government money. They get some government money to support the schools, even though they're private schools. And he says, now the parents don't support, not so much, he says. They don't support the school like they used to do. And of course, I talked this morning also about universal basic income. If you go back in the previous shows, you can hear what I said about Milton Friedman was actually for universal basic income. And people point that out all the time. And he mentions it in his book, Capitalism. And you think, well, how could he want universal basic income? Well, in what form? Under what conditions? And for what purpose? You see, if you don't read the whole story, you're going to get, this is what you do with the Bible. You don't read the whole story. You don't put it in the context. You don't put Paul in the context of Christ. And so no wonder you misinterpret Paul. But Milton Friedman says, only as a negative income tax and all other giveaway programs, social welfare programs, welfare state programs have to stop. And they know, you know, some of the figures came up to $12,000 a year. It would be inadequate. There will be problems that come up in a family or even an individual where $12,000 a year is not going to cover your needs. And they understood that. And so what happens is that other communities, other social projects had to take up the slack. And you'd be surprised at how well-mannered a beneficiary of welfare will become when he knows that what he's receiving automatically will be insufficient. And he's going to have to depend upon the good graces of other people. Now, one of the big problems isn't the fact that people are begging. It's the fact that people are giving to people that are begging without due diligence. They're not checking. What is he doing with this? Why is he begging? What is his real problem? And we delude ourselves into thinking that we are being charitable by giving away to people who really are undeserving. So we have to be a little bit more scientific about it and realize that charity is not automatic. Even though, according to science, everything is essentially mechanical, charity is not mechanical. You don't get charity because you're poor. You get charity because you're the deserving poor, because you may have made mistakes and that's why you're poor, and we are going to forgive those mistakes. But you have to be repentant. You have to be seeking a way that you're not going to make those mistakes again this week or this month. And so we have to hold the poor accountable and do due diligence in the giving to the poor. Otherwise, we're weakening them or enabling them. They talk in science, all matter is unconscious. I don't believe that. I not only believe that matter can have a sort of consciousness, it can have your consciousness. You can project your consciousness. I mean, it's like a recording. You know, a digital recording. You tell people, my voice is on this little disc. Well, that's ridiculous. How could your voice be on that disc? Well, it can be. It can be recorded in the nooks and crannies and grooves. And the reality is consciousness is when you're conscious and you're aware, you can actually be recording how you're aware, your conscience, your emotions into objects. Done all the time, been done for thousands of years. How do you detect this? Well, I mean, they know plants respond to the emotions of people around them. That's not a secret. They respond to music. Those are duplicatable experiments. So there's a lot more to consciousness than we imagine. And there's a lot of people who think they're conscious and it's actually, they're partially unconscious. So the third law is the total amount of matter and energy is always the same. Maybe, but how you can say that in the whole universe, because there seems to be black holes that energy is coming out of. We built this gigantic CERN machine to detect energy that pops out of nowhere and disappears into nowhere. We don't know where it's coming from. Well, it's from another dimension. So the amount of matter and energy is the same if we include all dimensions. How? We just don't know. That's a huge assumption and with poor scientific proof. Number four, the laws of nature are fixed. Well, there's evidence that, you know, the speed of light is changing. And the way they fix this, and gravity, the big G gravity, is fluctuating. Now, why is it fluctuating? Is it if we don't even really know what gravity is? Is gravity affected by things that we haven't been able to detect? We are so presumptuous. Now, I won't have time to go into that in detail, but another rule is nature is purposeless. Evolution has no goal or direction. Now, doesn't make sense. How do you come up with these sophisticated systems? Just by random and consistently. How did the first wasp know to sting that roach under his mantle in that particular part of his brain only? And then he would be able to lead the wasp around. The cockroach around. The wasp could lead the cockroach around and then make him stay there until he ends up becoming dinner for the children of the wasp. How did he come up with that plan? No, there are not only purposes in the operation of creation. There is a consciousness that is moving from generation to generation that is beyond biology. It says all biological inheritance is material carried in genetic material, DNA, and other material structures. I mean, these are religious doctrines that you have to believe, supposedly, in science. But they don't really make any sense because there's all kinds of evidence that something else is going on here. And you should be able to just see it, but they want to say, oh, no, you have to be able to put it in a test tube and prove it. But everything is not, if everything was just DNA, then we are just machines and we aren't accountable and there is no standard of morality in the universe. Talks about minds are inside the head and are nothing but activities of the brain. There is so much evidence that something else is going on where you have, you know, a twin on one side of the planet and you do something to the twin on the other side of the planet and the one knows it. You know, I've given stories about the daughter who was given up for adoption against the wishes of a young girl in high school who ended up marrying the father and remaining married all their life and never being able to have another child, but end up having that daughter come back and work at their business as their employee to the point where they were so good at it, the actual real mother wanted to turn over the business to her real daughter because she was so attached to this girl and she did not know it was her real daughter because of the fact that she didn't know until much later when she realized that this girl had been born on the same day. And then she found out that she had been adopted and that this girl that worked for her was her daughter. And this was not in some small town. This is in cities with millions of people. And she ends up working for her real mother and attached to her real mother. Just a coincidence, right? No, it doesn't work that way. This is, whether you want to call it morphic resonance or the spirit of God moving through things, or your spirit moving through things, you're drawn towards things. I don't need more proof than what I've seen, but I could show you all kinds of proof that there are connections beyond statistics that just cannot be accounted for except for the fact that there is something real out there that is not simply physical. Whether you want to call it telepathic or spiritual, whatever. Number 8, memories are stored as material traces in the brain and wiped out at death. Well, prove it. Where's your scientific proof for that? You have no proof for that whatsoever. It's a totally unscientific statement. You cannot prove that in any way, shape, or form. And there's a lot of evidence that the activities of the brain are not simply inside the brain, or how else is that twin able to experience things miles away? I mean, how many twins are, you know, affected by what their twin is doing? Twins that are separated at birth and have a commonality in life that is It has nothing to do with their environment. They are raised in separate environments. Children switched in the hospital at birth, growing up with families that are not really their families, but having all the same reactions and characteristics of their real family that's somewhere else, and proclivities of their real family that is somewhere else. Is that just genetic? Or is there genetic receptors that are allowing you to sense what is going on with the rest of the family? I experience this with our families very close. I don't need more proof, but the proof is certainly out there, at least unexplained phenomena, which brings us to number 9, unexplained phenomena like telepathy or telepathy are illusory. They just state that, but it isn't. I mean, we have seen it. We've experienced it. It's not illusionary. It is no way answering questions that the other person is thinking about in their mind at a given time that has nothing to do with anything that has been said whatsoever. You know, I mean, people do it all the time. The evidence is overwhelming that there's more to this connection than we would like to imagine. Mechanistic medicine is the only kind of that really works. Completely debunked. Although there's an awful lot of what is clearly cures going on all the time that has nothing to do with medicine, although it may have something to do with habits and eating. There are definitely people that are completely cured without any mechanical influence upon those people. But anyway, we're coming to the end of the show, and we can talk about this and many other things and aspects of the kingdom. If you want to come to the festival, let us know. Lots of information up there at burningbushfestival.com. We will also like to see you on the network and join the congregations of the network, because there's an inner network, and unless you join an actual congregation, you will not know about the inner network or what goes on there, because we're a little bit of a secret society. Anyway, we'll see you. God bless.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.